When I heard what the topic for today was going to be, I immediately thought of something I hadn't thought of for maybe 15 years. So this story comes to you from Kathmandu. The story takes place in Kathmandu, Nepal, in 1996 and 97. We returned in 1998. Edgar was the chief executive officer of a large development organization of 40 different kindred groups and 17 countries. One of those agencies had a guest house directly across from our house. And one morning, I got a desperate call from the new hostess manager who had just arrived within the last week or so. She said, "I need prayer. I need prayer. Will you pray with me? I need prayer." And then she didn't tell me the particulars. I learned those later. But she had just been with the staff. They had guests in the building. She had just been with her staff, and they had made fun of her Nepali. It wasn't like Nepali. It was like what they could hear and imagine. And they had what she could hear and imagine. And the staff were just poking fun at her and laughing and having a wonderful time. And she broke into tears, and that's when she called me. So we set a time for her, and she came that afternoon. And then she told me more about what they had said to her. When she had gotten off the telephone with me and gone back to them, where they were already beginning to work, she said that they had tried to apologize in English for being so rude to her. So she felt like she had a start in the new agency as the guest house manager hostess. After she told me about this, she asked me to pray for her and for the staff. She brought all manner of concerns and knew, I couldn't believe, so much about each of the staff's life and their problems and what was going on with them. There were 8 or 9 of them. So that began a tradition that when she had time, she would call and say, "May I come for prayer?" She wanted to talk about many things, such as, is God female or male? Females are much kinder than men are. I think God must be female. How does God interact with us? Do we know God when we're silent and we think about God? Or when is God talking to us and talking to me? And one that I liked, is God multilingual? To take care of all the needs of the world that are offered to him. And then she would laugh and say to her,
God is love. Love is God. I see the love, the goodness of God pretty much whenever I look for it. And here are a few examples. The first one is a story of seeing God in myself and in my patients. Many decades ago, I worked in the adolescent unit of a private psychiatric hospital in Columbus, Ohio. My sheltered life growing up in small-town Scottsdale, Pennsylvania, and going to college in small-town Goshen, Indiana, did not prepare me for these teenagers. A few of them were psychotic, but back in those days, most of them were just abusing drugs or had out-of-control behavior problems. The way they looked, their clothes, their talk, their music were disgusting. And that's why I know that the love that I gave them was God's love. I did not like them, but I loved them, and they knew that. In this hospital, there was a rule that the staff could not touch the patients unless you were putting them into restraints. I went to the director of the hospital, and I told him that I was a nurse and a mother, and these girls needed hugs. He finally agreed with me. And with their permission, I would hold these hurting children and tell them that I could see the good in them. Obviously that still moves me. Years later, we would see them in the community, and they would say how I saved their lives. Many of them had never known the love or gentle hug from an adult. It wasn't me that saved them. It was God's love that gave them hope. Next, the poor women of India. Jeff and I spent 2 months in India when Glenn and Marilyn were directors of MCC India. And we had the privilege of visiting many of the small villages where the women were engaged in MCC projects. These women had few material possessions, but they would always come out to meet us with smiles and flowers and dancing. They were overflowing with love and joy. And when they said namaste to us, may the spirit within me honor the spirit within you, they were totally sincere. Sometimes when there's so much evidence of evil and violence in our country, it's really hard for me to see God. But the last several weeks after the tragic shootings, I did see God. I was moved by the pictures I saw of police people giving and receiving hugs. White skin touching dark skin. The little white girl that gave flowers to the little black boy. The love of God. I was inspired and challenged when I heard President Obama speak, preach, at the memorial service for the slain police people. I have a friend who's African American and lived most of her life in Chicago. She saw way too much gun violence in her lifetime. And of course, she was devastated when these shootings happened, when again two black men were killed by white policemen. But I didn't hear a word of bitterness. She just repeatedly said, we need to show more of God's love. We need to be ambassadors for God. I saw this love and being ambassadors for God in the leaders and the people who walked in the Goshen Peace March Wednesday night. I don't have time to tell you the many ways that I see love in my family and friends, but I do have to mention Jep. For any of you who have talked to him this summer for like more than 20 seconds, you know that he loves his gardens. He says it's a spiritual discipline, just him and God, the soil, and his plants. Every day when he brings me flowers and vegetables, which he cleans, I am so aware of the love of my husband and my God. The last thing I want to mention is you, my faith community. I see God in millions of ways. I especially see that in the way we treat our children, in the way we minister to each other in time of crisis. I've been here 4 years, and that still amazes me, just amazes me. Thank you.
So Julie sent out an email early last week asking for people to help her out with this. Several of us thought about it, and at some point we're told we'd be the ones, but I didn't have any idea who those people were. I just want to make that clear. We were not in cahoots. Here's what I wrote. It says it right here. God is love. There is no great expounding theology in my understanding of the thing we call God. It's just as simple as that. God is love, and love is God. I'm grateful that my experience in finding sacred love in the ordinary came from the two people who created me. 9 years ago, I participated in a week-long poetry writing workshop led by an extraordinary being who had gotten me through some rough years. Farron's music and lyrics often left me speechless, and here I found myself learning from her how to compose a sestina. Not an easy task. In the sestina form of poetry, there's a specific pattern to repeating the same six words at the ends of the six lines of the first six stanzas of the poem, and in the seventh stanza, all six words are included, in no particular order, into three lines. Got that? I took a few liberties, but basically my six words ended up being dies, hell, boy, I, leaving, and goodbye. At the end of the week, all workshop participants read aloud their sestina to the other three. No. At the end of the week, all workshop participants read aloud their sestina to the others three times. The first time through listening for the pattern, the second time listening for the meaning, and the third time just to absorb the poem. So that's what I've chosen to offer to you today, even though I think some of you have heard this before, this particular sestina. Here's an explanation about the title. The last line in one of Farron's songs is, I'm looking for something outside of forgiveness. You might call it the jewel of the crown. His last goodbye, or the jewel of the crown. There are things he wants to say before he dies. He wants to tell me not to choose hell. Instead, he becomes a small boy, singing childhood ditties with a twinkle in his eye. We'll miss you, he says, as I'm leaving. There he stands, bare feet on the porch in his pajamas, waving goodbye. The next time I visit, we don't say goodbye. Cancer seeps through his bones and brain as he dies. He doesn't even comprehend that I'm leaving. I walk away from that living hell, his shriveled body and bulging eye. He bears little resemblance to that smiling boy. While growing up, I often wish I were a boy. I do my best to be good by every means possible. I keep my eye on things above. And when I'm 9, his mother dies. I do not question whether or not she went to hell. I do not question the reasons for her leaving. Death is not so much about leaving as it is about changing. You can say, oh boy, another dissertation about heaven and hell. Or you can simply say goodbye. And if you've loved, the you that dies lives on through loved ones' eyes. Lately, my mother's eyes are sadly hopeful. So this was written in 2007 when she was still alive. She seems to be leaving the straight and narrow. Once he dies, she no longer cares for that aging boy who's only once hugged me goodbye. She's no longer immersed in his living hell. As for me, his perceptions of hell never came to be. My eyes do not imagine that all of life can say goodbye and punish me for made-up sin. I'm leaving all that thought behind. What buoys me now is that his soul is free, though his body died, and that while leaving his body, his fear of hell has died as well. I choose to see him as a boy with a twinkle in his eye, his last goodbye.
With an apologetic nod to Mitch Albom, I am calling this story Saturdays with John. John is my dad. John is nearly 84 years old and legally blind from macular degeneration. He also has pain and neuropathy in his legs and feet. Nearly every Saturday morning for the past 3 years, I've gone to my parents' home at Walnut Court. Sometimes I write checks for Dad or read something to him that came in the mail. Always we go grocery shopping at Aldi, and sometimes we make brief stops at the bank, the pharmacy, or the dollar store. Then we go back to Walnut Court. I fill my mom's med box, and I go home. Sounds pretty ordinary. So where is the divine in these encounters? Let me tell you about John. John grew up in a home where poverty, mental illness, neglect, and abuse were daily realities. If John were growing up today, he would be diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum, specifically what we used to call Asperger's. He also would have been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. He put himself through college and seminary and married young. He was a very young parent with 4 children by the time he was 27 and a 5th when he was 31. John found it difficult, almost impossible, to do many things that we neurologically normative people take for granted, such as reading the emotions in people's faces and words, or having a conversation with more than one person at a time, or enjoying a play or a radio broadcast or a TV movie, since he has great difficulty processing auditorily. Being with his 5 children was very trying. Just living was exhausting work. When he got home from work, he would usually disappear down the basement to his wood shop. Growing up as John's child was painful, literally so. The spankings and slaps were inappropriate. Having a parent who could not look you in the eyes, did not know how to express affection, seemed always inattentive, and could not listen was a recipe for repressed anger and low self-esteem. I first realized that I could read at about the age of 4 or 5 because I noticed the words he would skip in his eagerness to be finished when Mom made him read library books to us. When I was an adult, he would say things such as, "I don't want to know what you think about that," or, when I left for a long trip, "Goodbye, keep in touch, but not too often." So how is it that I, as an adult, and especially in the past 3 years, experience God's presence when I'm with John? Thich Nhat Hanh says that compassion comes through understanding, and that to understand another person, we must be able to know deeply the pain the other person experiences. We do this by moving outside of ourselves and into the other person's ways of experiencing and perceiving the world. If it takes a village to raise a child, I believe it often takes a faith community such as ours to heal a no longer young woman and her aging father. I don't discount therapy and pharmaceuticals, but it is the brothers and sisters here who have healed me. By looking into my eyes with love, by listening to me and mirroring me, by touching me gently, by walking alongside me in my struggle to relate to each of my parents, I have been able, in turn, to provide those gifts to John. Let's return to Saturday morning. As we drive to Aldi, I am quiet. I don't chatter, which would make him work hard to process what I'm trying to say and not give him time to think what he wants to say. When he's ready, he comments on his surroundings or brings up a memory. I relax and allow for silence. I don't give advice and only rarely make suggestions. I speak clearly and slowly. I let him take the lead. I notice John's cheerfulness, his resilience, his acceptance of his physical limitations. I notice that I am calm, pleased with his happiness. I no longer need his attention or approval. I am content to simply be with him. I am grateful for my own healing that allows this to be so. And so God is present, and in her presence and the faithful presence of God's people, we are healed.